This is episode number 46 with Alex Benayan.
Welcome to the Rise Higher podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Kwong, and each week I'll bring you an inspiring guest with an empowering message to help you rise higher and live your best life. Each guest shares their time of struggle and setback and what specific mindsets, tools, practices, or habits they use to overcome so that you can apply them to your life. This show is to remind you that you're not alone and that there's always a pathway up. Thanks for spending some time with me today. I'm grateful to be on this journey with you. Our struggles are a call for us to rise. So here we go. Let's dive deep now so we can rise higher together. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Rise Higher podcast. Thank you so much for spending some of your precious time with me today and with my awesome guest, Alex Benayan. So Alex's story is crazy inspiring, and I know that when you hear it, you are absolutely gonna love it. So at 18 years old, Alex had an epiphany that the path that he had been on his entire life wasn't the one that he wanted. And I'm sure that many people can relate to that, that we're on a path that someone else has designed for us or desires us to be on. We're walking on it, and all of a sudden you're like, what the heck am I doing? This isn't what I desire. This was someone else's dream. And that was exactly what happened for Alex. And so instead of continuing with pre-med, Alex risked it all. And the day before his freshman year final exams, he hacked the TV show, The Price is Right. He won a sailboat, he sold it, and then he used the prize money to fund his quest to learn from the world's most successful people on how they built their success and to write a book sharing all of the things that he discovered. So over the next 7 years, Alex went on a journey tracking down people like Bill Gates, Maya Angelou, Steve Wozniak, Jane Goodall, Quincy Jones, Lady Gaga, Tim Ferriss, and many, many more. And Alex was on a mission to uncover how these individuals broke through and launched their careers. I mean, Alex, you're going to hear in his story, he did some pretty crazy things. I mean, he even chased Larry King down in a grocery store, and he snuck into Warren Buffett's shareholders meeting. And in Alex's book, The Third Door, he shares all of his lessons that he learned from this experience. And in this episode with Alex, you're going to see that his story and all that he learned along his journey is just as fascinating and valuable is what he learned from all of the big names that he interviewed. So Alex has been named to Forbes 30 Under 30 list and Business Insider's Most Powerful People Under 30. And he's contributed to Fast Company, The Washington Post, Entrepreneur, and TechCrunch. And he's been featured in major media, including Fortune, Forbes, Business Week, Billboard, Bloomberg TV, CNBC, Fox News, MSNBC, and CBS News. And as an acclaimed keynote speaker, Alex has presented the Third Door framework to business conferences and corporate leadership teams around the world, including Apple, Google, Nike, IBM, Snapchat, Disney, Harvard, and countless others. Now, this episode is filled with powerful lessons, and some of the things that we chat about are what the third door is and why it's essential for your success, how to achieve your goals despite your fear, the dangers of over-persistence, the one thing that some of the most successful people in the world share, how to move beyond self-doubt, the key to getting unstuck and to stop playing small, how to jumpstart achieving your dreams and goals, the power of courage and using it to overcome any obstacle. And Alex shares all the ups and downs of his journey to interview these accomplished people and to write his book, and of course, so much more. So you're going to get some big old nuggets of wisdom from Alex in this episode, and I can't wait for you to hear the essential qualities that you got to embody to move beyond fear to generate success and also how to keep going when it seems nearly impossible so that you can truly channel your greatness. Now, you're definitely going to want to share this episode out with your friends and your family. So start sharing by taking a screenshot of this podcast that you're listening to, post it on Instagram, on your stories or in your feed, and tag me at I am Stephanie Kwong to spread the love and so that I can find you to shout you back. All right, let's dive in right now with Alex. Here we go. Alex Benayan, welcome to the Rise Higher podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so awesome to be here with you and have you on the show. You've had such an incredible ride in like less than a year because your book came out in June, but I know it was...
Yeah, it's just been 6 months now.
So you guys, as I already said in the intro, Alex wrote this amazing book called The Third Door, which you must get your hands on. But for those who don't know what it means, what does The Third Door mean?
So for the past 7 years, mm-hmm. I've been, you know, tracking down the world's most successful people and figuring out when they were just starting out how they did it. And when I first started this journey, I was 18 years old and, you know, we can go into the context later of how it all got started, but I had no intention of finding that, you know, one key to success. You know, we've all seen those TED Talks or those business books that promise like the one secret. And normally I just, you know, yes. roll my eyes. But what ended up happening on this 7 year journey after, you know, hundreds of hours of research, going through, you know, thousands of pages and sitting down and interviewing the people I was dying to get answers from. It didn't matter if it was Bill Gates for business or Lady Gaga for music or Maya Angelou or Jane Goodall or Jessica Alba. I realized every single one of them treats life and business and success the exact same way. And I don't know if you're a big music fan, but it was almost like there was this common melody to every single interview I was doing. And the analogy that came to me, because I was like 21 at the time, was that it's sort of like getting into a nightclub. Mm-hmm. So there's always three ways in. There's the first door, the main entrance, where the line curves around the block, where 99% of people wait around hoping to get in. That's the first door. And then there's the second door, the VIP entrance, where the billionaires and celebrities go through. And for some reason, school and society have this way of making us feel like those are the only two ways in. You're either born into it or you wait your turn. Mm-hmm. But what I learned is that there's always, always the third door.
Always.
Right? It's the entrance door. You jump out of line, run down the alley, bang on the door 100 times, crack open the window, go through the kitchen. There's always a way in. I mean, it doesn't matter if that's how Gates sold his first piece of software or how Spielberg became the youngest director in Hollywood history. They all took the third door. So that's not only the title and thesis of the book, that's really the energy that I'm hoping to inject into the readers.
Well, and inject you do, because it was literally your journey of finding multiple third doors to achieve creating this book in your 7 year journey. I know you said it took, what, 4 years to write it, 4 years to interview, 3 years to write it.
Yeah, well done. Yeah, because it was four, I would say even a little bit more. I would say, and there was some overlap, you know, 4 years of interviewing and research, 3 years of writing, and then a whole year of just editing. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of work.
Yeah, and this wasn't a path that you initially thought you were going to be on. Or you thought, of course, it was so funny because I know you share the story. You're like, I'm the immigrant son of, you know, Persians. And I'm like, I'm a daughter of immigrants from China. And so there is a certain, I had MD slapped on my ass, as well as also lawyer, engineer, and or like a CEO of some company, right?
God forbid. If you can be a lawyer or a doctor, an engineer, you can be a CEO.
Yeah, but must be CEO. So that was kind of your path too. You thought you were going to be a doctor and then things turned for you. I'd love for you to share that. What was the shift?
I didn't even think I was going to be a doctor. I knew I was going to be a doctor because, look, when you're young, and if you're lucky enough to have, you know, parents and grandparents who love you, when you're a kid, all you really want is, you know, the positive reinforcement of the people who love you. And I, you know, I wore scrubs to school for Halloween in third grade and thought I was cool. You know, that was my childhood growing up. I remember in kindergarten, my mom, instead of putting our finger paintings on the refrigerator, she put a skeleton chart. So that was my childhood. So by the time I get to college, you know, I'm the pre-med of pre-meds, but very quickly I found myself on my dorm room bed looking at this towering stack of biology books and feeling like they're dementors, you know, sucking the life out of me. And at first I assumed I was just being lazy. Because, you know, it's when you know you're going to be a doctor and you don't want to open your, you know, your pre-med books, the only obvious reason you're not doing it is you're just being lazy. Mm-hmm. You're like, maybe you just need to sleep a little to get your energy back. But eventually I started to wonder because, you know, college was really the first time in my entire life. You know, I grew up with, you know, like you, an immigrant family, and you never really have, and we grew up in like a sort of small house where we're all on top of each other. You never really have a moment alone, at least for me. The first time I ever, I know this sounds preposterous, but the first time I ever was alone to think for myself was when I started college and I moved into the dorms. It's actually crazy. I've never really thought about that. Because even like on summer vacation in high school, I'm like home with my sisters and my parents. Like I never went to sleepaway camp. I never traveled alone. I never even was allowed to sleep over at a friend's house. So there was actually never real, wow, this is actually weird to think back. I can't think other than sleeping over at like my grandma's house, like once every few months as a treat. But even then, my grandma is just her. My older mom, you know? Yeah. It's not like I'm
there's
like-
There's just less people. Not that there's no people, it's just less now.
Correct. So college, when I was 18, was the first time I ever sort of had space. And I just started naturally wondering whether I was on my path or if I was on a path somebody placed me on and I was just rolling down. And I started going through the what I want to do with my life crisis, and those questions naturally started to evolve into, okay, not only do I not know what I wanted to do, how did all these people who I looked up to, how did they do it? You know, how did Bill Gates sell his first piece of software out of his dorm room when nobody knew his name? How did Lady Gaga get her first record deal without a single hit under her belt? You know, this is what they don't teach you in school. Mm-hmm. You go to college thinking you're going to, you know, learn how to achieve a dream, and you end up going to college and you're studying like linguistics 101, you know, which I fucking love linguistics too. Funny enough, I use that as an example. That was one of my favorite class in college. It's just not what you, you know, are so hungry to learn.
And those are the prerequisites. So you kind of have to do them.
Right. And, I'm not knocking that, but it wasn't what I was craving. Mm-hmm. And I just assumed, let me go figure it out on my own. I went to the library, I went on Amazon, and I just started ripping through business books and biographies and self-help books, assuming there had to be a book out there with the answers. Because what I was looking for was a single book that focused on not a particular age in life, but really a stage. When no one's taking your calls, no one's taking your meetings, how do you find a way to break through? And eventually I was left empty-handed. So that's when my naive 18-year-old thinking kicked in. And I thought, well, if no one's written the book I'm dreaming of reading, why not write it myself? You know, I thought it'd be very simple. I'll just call up Bill Gates and interview him.
Easy.
Interview everybody else, and I'd be done in a few months. That I assumed would be the easy part. The hard part, I figured, was getting the money to fund the journey. You know, it would cost money to fly up to Seattle and, you know, interview Bill and interview everybody else. But I was buried in student loan debt. I was all out of bar mitzvah cash. So there had to be a way to break through and get some money. And two nights before final exams, my freshman year of college, I'm in the library doing what everyone's doing in the library right before finals. I'm on Facebook. And
so you're supposed to be doing two nights before finals.
And I'm like scrolling through my newsfeed and I see someone offering free tickets to The Price is Right, you know, the longest running game show in U.S. history. And my first thought was, you know, I was in L.A. going to college. So it was filming sort of nearby where I went to school. And my first thought was, what if I just go on the show and win some money to fund this book? You know, not my brightest moment. Plus, I had a problem. I'd never seen a full episode of the show before. Look, everybody in America, when they're in like fourth grade and homesick from school, The Price is Right is like the only thing on TV when we were kids. So I've seen bits and pieces, but I've never seen like a full episode of the show before. But I thought, you know, how hard could it be? But, you know, I told myself it was a dumb idea to not think about it. I had finals in 2 days. I needed to focus. But I don't know if you've ever had one of these moments where an idea keeps clawing itself back into your mind. So to prove to myself it was a bad idea, I remember taking out my spiral notebook. I'm sitting at this round wooden table in the library. I open up my spiral notebook and I write best and worst case scenarios to prove to myself it's a bad idea. And I remember like very vividly, you know, worst case scenarios, you know, fail finals, get kicked out of pre-med, lose financial aid, mom stops talking to me. No, mom kills me. You know, there's like 20, there's like 20 cons. And the only pro is maybe win enough money to fund this dream. And it was almost as if somebody had tied a rope around my gut and was slowly pulling in a direction. So that night, I decided to do the logical thing and pull an all-nighter to study. But I didn't study for finals. I studied how to hack The Price is Right. Mm-hmm. And I went on the show the next day and executed this ridiculous strategy. And I ended up winning the whole showcase showdown, winning a sailboat, selling the sailboat. And that's how I funded the book.
I freaking love that story. You said two things, actually, that are kind of interesting. Like the first was you said it was naive of you to think that you could write this book, right? And then the second was, it wasn't my brightest idea to think I could go on this show and like this is how I'd get the money. But that's exactly what happened. Like this book, this naive idea of like, oh, I could write a book, not realizing what it would take, turned into a book of possibilities for people, which I know we'll dive into deeper. And then also this bright idea actually was a freaking bright idea because you won it. You kicked Tanisha's butt on the showcase showdown. You didn't even realize you won, which is so crazy. Did you? Yeah. And
yeah.
Sammy sent me a video and I watched it and you're like, I'm looking at the podium going, it's blinking.
Yeah.
And you won and you didn't realize. And that is what spawned this beautiful journey for you. How do you see, even for people when they're, like when you were feeling that tug, how many people you've met that they feel that tug, like that rope tied around them and they don't answer the call, what would you tell them instead? I mean, obviously it's the logical answer, but sometimes people are so scared to listen to that voice, Alex, but you did. Like what would you tell people if they, their mind is telling them one thing and their gut is telling them something else? What would you guide them to do?
You know, something that's important to remember is that it's not like I'm doing this shit every day, you know? It's not like I'm like Evel Knievel jumping off cliffs and shit. Like I, if you talk to my sisters, I have two sisters, an older and younger sister, they'll tell you that I was the most scared kid you would ever meet growing up. Like I had a nightlight on until I was 12. I never went on roller coasters. I like still don't watch any scary movies. I'm just like a scared kid. And when I think back to The Price is Right, you know, really the origin of how this whole 7-year journey got started, the reason that worked, the reason that entire experience came to be, as crazy as the day of The Price is Right was, that wasn't what made it possible. What made it possible is what you alluded to, it was the night before, sitting there in the library with that pro and cons list. Mm. And what I've learned is that the moments that change your life the most, when you're 80 years old, looking back on your life, the moments that change the course of your life are when you're staring at 20 logical good reasons not to do something. Logical, you know, for financial reasons, for academic reasons, for family reasons. Not be murdered by your parents. Correct. You know, 20 good reasons not to do something. Mm-hmm. Yet for some reason that you don't even understand in that moment, something in you is just whispering. It's not even shouting. It's whispering to still go forward anyway. And it's those moments that change the course of your life.
Yes. You had the courage to answer that call, the whisper. I feel there's so many people, because in what I do for a living, it's so many people hearing the whisper even hearing the yells sometimes, and still paralyzed in fear and not being able to take any steps forward. What would you tell them?
One of the biggest, if not the biggest traits that the world's most successful people share across the board is also one of the things that I was the most curious about going into these interviews. You know, like I said, I was like this really scared kid. And not only was I a scared kid, the second I started actually working on this book, you know, after I won The Price is Right, I, you know, had some money and I was like, all right, it's time to get going. And the first thing that happened was my biggest nightmare. I became completely paralyzed by fear. And I thought, you know, okay, I'm just scared because it's the beginning. And then I would keep going. And then I was scared. There was not a single step of the process, even the book launch. You know, I've been working on this for 7 years. Even the book launch, completely paralyzed.
What were you afraid of?
Oh, my God. Everything.
Like?
For the book launch specifically or the whole 7 years?
All of it.
If I peel back the layers, there's probably one core fear of being a failure. And then if you pull that back, it's not enough. If you pull that back, it's I'm not loved. If you pull that back, it's I'll be completely alone and die alone. You know? Yes. That, if you really pull it back, it's not like, yes, I have that thought consciously, but if you pull it back, that's sort of the core essence.
Of course, of course.
You know, Buddhism talks about it a lot. That is the seed of fear that is born into every human being. And it's, you know, our job to sort of water that seed and bring it to light and care for it so it doesn't have a stranglehold over us. Mm-hmm. Now, so I go into these interviews sort of obsessively curious about how all these people, you know, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, how did they become so fearless? You know, that must be the only solution to how, there's no way Elon Musk or Bill Gates could do what they did without being fearless. And what happened is I kept doing these interviews. I kept doing, you know, these years of research. And what ended up happening is I just came to the same conclusion every single time, no matter how much I kept looking for a different kind of answer. And it's that every single one of these people was scared in the beginning. And not only were they scared in the beginning, they were terrified the whole way through, which didn't make any sense to me. And what I learned is that it wasn't fearlessness they achieved, it was courage. And while the words sound similar, the difference is critical.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is critical. And anyone out there who's like trying to start a business, trying to achieve a dream, or just trying to be the person they want to be, this is the single most important thing I could share, which is that courage and fearlessness, the difference is that fearlessness is jumping off of a cliff and not thinking about it. That's idiotic. You know, if you tell me that that's you're fearless, crazy, right? If yeah, you tell me you're fearless, I want nothing to do with you. You're crazy. Courage, on the other hand, is acknowledging your fears, analyzing the consequences, and then deciding you care so much about it, you're still going to take one thoughtful step forward anyway.
Mm. That's so powerful. Because I think so many people want to wait till the fear is gone, the timing is right, I'm skilled enough, good enough, and then I will. And that's when I forgot who said, if you want to find the place where the most potential lies, go to a cemetery. Because most people go to their grave with potential.
Yeah, and I think from my own personal experience, I always would see fear as a signal that there's something wrong. And every point of this journey, it doesn't matter if I was trying to get interviews or if I was trying to get a book deal or if I was trying to write the book or if I was trying to launch them, I always saw fear as a neon sign that there's something wrong with how I'm doing this. And it's taken me 7-8 years to finally learn that fear is a natural part of the human experience.
So there are different levels of fear that you had to move through in this journey. The first being telling your mother that you were not going to finish med school and you're going to go on this journey. And I would love for you to share why you were so afraid and then how you moved beyond that fear to commit to this journey.
It's so wild how it's, you know, this was 7-8 years ago and I remember it so vividly. You know, there's some memories that are like scorched into your mind.
Totally.
For better or for worse. And I remember being 18. And the context is important because for most people, switching a major in college is not, you know, life or death. Some people switch their majors 10 times. Not a big deal. For me, especially in my childhood and teenage years, being a doctor wasn't just a major that I happened to choose in college. It was, you know, my family's from Iran. And they fled Iran as refugees because they were Jewish, and if they stayed there, they would have been killed. And they came to America, and I pretty much had a very simple direction, which was, we will sacrifice, you know, parents said it explicitly and implicitly, we are sacrificing everything to give you an education so you don't have to suffer the way we suffered. So there was a lot more riding on it than just, you know, picking a major. And I even remember, you know, I'm 6 years old one night, and you know, when you have a nightmare and you're a little kid, you like jump out of bed and like run to your parents. And I remember climbing out of bed in the middle of the night and walking down the hallway to my parents' room, and I see like a blue light coming from under the door, and this is middle of the night. I remember cracking the door open and seeing my mom like hunched over a little desk working on a computer at like 3 or 4 a.m. I like went back to sleep, and the next night I woke up and I started doing it again, And it wasn't until I was much older that I found out that at that time my dad's used car lot went bankrupt, and it was up to my mom to really keep the family afloat. And she's working, you know, pretty much 20 hours a day. And it's that level of sacrifice my parents made for us, for me and my sisters, that made even the thought of not being a doctor feel like the greatest act of betrayal in human history.
Yes. Wow.
In hindsight, it wasn't. But at the time, that's what it felt like. And I was actually talking to this like renowned psychologist. She's brilliant. And I was talking to her, and she was explaining to me a word I didn't understand called individualization, which is when a person becomes an individual, the process of becoming an individual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking about it, and she's like, yeah, you know, an individualization, an act of betrayal is required. And I was like, required? Ooh. I remember literally leaning back in my chair as if like she just like insulted me. I was like, required? It doesn't have to be required. She's like, no, by definition, you cannot individualize without betraying the tribe that you're currently in. And I was like, ooh. Oh shit.
Wow.
And the word betrayal is so heavy. It's you know, a dark word, dark topic, you know. But at the end of the day, I guess there's different kinds of betrayal. You know, there could be the fucked up betrayal where you stab someone in the back, but there's also the type of betrayal where there's a set of core values that actually aren't serving you. You can still love the people, you can still be loving and kind and compassionate. But the day you decide you're not, those values are not your values. It doesn't even have to be all of them, but even one. That's that act of betrayal. And that's the requisite to individualizing. And I'll tell you, that is the hardest part of the cool thing about the third door is that now that it's out, I've been talking to readers, hearing their stories, and I've just been talking to on book tour thousands and thousands of readers about their own third door stories. And it is abundantly clear that the hardest part of taking the third door is not in the executing. Everyone says, you know, well, I can't achieve my dream because I have no idea how I'll achieve it. And I've come to realize that is never the reason people don't achieve a dream. The reason they don't achieve a dream is they can't get themselves to leave the line for the first door. That's where it's well lit. That's where their friends are. That's where their family are. That's where they're getting their steady paycheck. That's where it's safe. I'm not knocking it.
No, yeah. And they have more of a belief that they'll get in if they wait their turn there than to...
I don't think so, actually.
Really?
I think that's what they tell themselves.
Okay.
Because they're fucking terrified.
Yeah.
Of what happens in that dark alley.
Yeah.
And, you know, what
I... And especially going by themselves.
Correct. Especially if you're the first person in your family or your friend group to do it. What ends up happening, though, is that when... Like when I dropped out of school, like 3 months later, two of my other friends dropped out of school, you know? So there is a, you know, fear is contagious, but so is courage.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, fear is contagious, but so is courage. And it's that leaving of the line of the first door. And again, the third door doesn't have to be for everybody. But if you do want to do something on your own, whether it's starting your own business, achieving your artistic dreams, or even just turning yourself into the person you always dreamed you could be, it is impossible to do that waiting around hoping someone hands it to you. You have to run down that alley and get it yourself. Mm.
So you individualized yourself then in that moment when you told your mom. What made that greater than your commitment to family? Because I know it's similar in my culture where it's like family first. It's like ingrained in you so deeply where it's community, family, and then individualization comes maybe in your next lifetime. Right?
In the afterlife.
In the afterlife.
That's
maybe,
a good one. That's a really
if your
good
karma
one.
Is correct.
That's funny.
But that was a really powerful move for you to do, because especially for someone who's afraid, will I lose love from my mom?
Felt like a suicide mission.
Right?
at the time.
So for
in hindsight, one of the best decisions I ever made. At the time, though, I was like, this could go either way. This could be the end of it. Mm. At the time, that's how it felt, for sure.
Okay. And then as you were going through the book then, moments of fear that came up, and how did you move through them, especially like the rejection part? Because it was, I was like,
by the rejection part, you mean the whole part?
Oh, yeah, that you did get through though to many of them. But I mean, I was so impressed, or in awe of really your relentlessness and the persistence to the point where I was almost like, ooh, Alex again, you know, where you just kept going in the face of so many no's. And especially for a kid who you self-described as someone who was scared, your courage was just so present through all of it. Like, how did you keep that momentum for yourself?
What ends up happening, you know, society is funny. We've come to terms that physical attributes have a, you know, a lot of people know about growth mindset and fixed mindset. You know, fixed mindset means the talent skills I have are fixed and there's nothing I can do about it. Growth mindset says the more I work on it, the better I'll get. We've come to terms as a society, Western society has come to terms that physical attributes in some ways, whether it's like lifting weights, for example, you want to bench press. I would say, you know, you stop 100 people on the street, 99 or maybe 100 out of 100 will say, yeah, the more you go to the gym, the more you can bench press. That's not a controversial issue. Everybody is in agreement. What's fascinating, and again, I don't knock anyone because it took me years to learn this myself, is that the same principles that apply to bench pressing and going to the gym and lifting weights, that growth mindset, also apply to intangible traits like courage and risk taking. The difference is that physical appearance is very clearly, you can track that. Mm-hmm. You know, your biceps are getting bigger. You can see it happening. Courage and risk taking, you don't really see it. All you see are the end results years later, and you wonder how that happened. And what I'll tell you is that with courage and with risk taking, it's just like going to the gym. You know, you haven't done it. You know, let's use myself as an example. I'm this sheltered kid. I haven't really taken any crazy risks. I'm 18 years old. And even just telling the thought of telling my mom I'm not interested in being a doctor. Forget about even I'm going to leave pre-med. I'm even too scared to even tell her about what I'm actually interested in life. That's, you know, the equivalent of going to a gym. You've never picked up a weight before and you pick up 5 pounds, and that even is, you can do it. It's pretty fucking hard, you know? And then you just go back to the gym and you lift 10 pounds the next week and 15 and then 20 and then 25 and oops, you just, you know, sprained your muscle. So you have to go back home and rest for, you know, a couple of weeks, and then you go mm-hmm. back to the gym, and you go back to 10 and 5th. You keep working your way up, and slowly, you know, it's been a year, 2 years, 3 years, and you're now bench pressing, you know, 150 pounds, 250 pounds. Never in the gym is like, wow, you were just born a natural athlete, and you just smile because you know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true about risk taking and courage. I'll tell you, it's, you know, I'm 26 right now. The kind of hard decisions I'm making in this year of my life are unimaginable to the 18-year-old version of myself. If I could go back in time to my 18-year-old self and tell them, you know, tell him the kind of decisions I've made just in the past month, he'd be like, that's impossible. Your entire family would never talk to you again. You know, like they're... It's that, I'm serious, it's that night and day. And
the questions now or the questions then would be affect your family?
You know, just in a big picture. Mm. And it's, you know, I talk about it with my sisters all the time that courage, the more weights
work
you
that
lift,
muscle.
The more you work that muscle, it's not the easier it gets, because I'll tell you, if you ask any bodybuilder, even when they work themselves up to bench pressing 300 pounds, it's not easy to bench 300 pounds. You're still like in agony and in pain, but you're doing 300. You're not doing 10 pounds.
Mm-hmm. And then when you go and you pick up that 10 pound though.
You don't. Why would you?
Well, yeah, and I'm just saying, right, you know, that it's like nothing. But
right.
Then,
you don't even feel it.
Yeah,
correct.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, a great example is public speaking. You know, the first time you speak in front of 5 people, it's terrifying. You know, and then you slowly, you know, over 10 years, just like bodybuilding, you work yourself up to you can speak in front of 10,000 people and feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Talking in front of 5 people is like drinking water.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. How do you turn up the volume on your dreams when your fear is so loud in your head?
What I've come to realize is that a lot of people talk about, I know what works for me. You know, I know what works for me. And this might not work for someone else, but I'll just share. Maybe it will. What works for me when I, you know, we talked about fearlessness and courage. To me, the key to the courage is not overcoming the fear. You know, I talked about acknowledging the fear, analyzing the consequences. That still doesn't make you want to take the leap. What makes me want to take the leap is then in the face of the fear, reminding myself how much I care about the end result and why it matters to me so much, and really being. And this is the thing. A lot of times, I'll tell you a great example. I was talking to a friend yesterday. Right now, we're planning the reason I'm hesitant is it hasn't been officially announced.
This won't come out for a few months.
So we are doing an international book tour. So yeah.
I'm dancing, guys, in front of Alex right
so
now.
So we were doing an international book tour. I was talking to a friend yesterday about which countries we're doing because the book comes out.
Yes.
The book comes out in 13 languages in 2019. Wow. And one of the countries that is, so the way it works is 13 international publishers have all, you know, made, you know, contracts with my publisher to, you know, translate and publish the books in these respective territories. One of them is Iran. I was telling a friend the other day, and I was like, you know, obviously it's very sentimental to me that the book is coming out in Farsi in the country where my family is from. At the same time, you know, you don't really want to be in Iran and get yourself, you know, in maybe a little accident and cross your fingers hoping, you know, Donald Trump helps you out. You know, it's not really the best climate, you know. You don't even know who works at the State Department in 2019. You know, it's that kind of climate. Probably not a risk I'm going to take.
Yeah.
Right? Because again, you know, it's analyzing not only the fears, but it's also analyzing why you care so much about it. But, you know, we go back to me leaving pre-med. What I cared about was making sure that when I was 80 or 90 years old, I wouldn't look back on my life and wonder what if. That was something that no amount of fear, no matter how uncomfortable and painful the fear was, none of it could stack up against the pain of being 90 years old and saying, I wasted my life.
The regret. What was the hardest thing for you to make this book?
The hardest. How many hours do you have?
Well, you only have 15 more minutes, dude.
Oh, it was all hard. That's so funny. It was, I actually never, it was all hard. I'm very grateful though, because I never had to do anything alone. Even though this is quote unquote, you know, a solo journey as an author. Yeah. In every stage, I was lucky enough that whether it's God or the universe, whatever you believe in, or, you know, serendipity, someone would come into my life and show me the way. So whether it was getting interviews for the book, a man named Elliot Bisno, who's the CEO of Summit Series, you know, came in and saved me and showed me how to build momentum and how to, you know, sort of work the system to, you know, get interviews. And then when it came to writing the book, I had no writing experience. And a man named Cal Fussman came into my life who, you know, Cal's a, you know, best-selling author, who's a writer at Esquire magazine. And he mentored me for three, 4 years, teaching me how to write. And I'm very, not just fortunate, but grateful for people who have in many ways shown me the way, because achieving a dream sometimes feels like going on a sailing trip in the dark of night. You know, there's no lighthouse, you have no compass, you just sort of know what direction you're hoping to go in, but that's about it. And, you know, storms hit and the tides might be crazy, and all you can do is really hold on tight and try your best and just keep going. And every now and then, if you're lucky, you hit shore and, you know, you can't help but fall to your knees and be grateful.
And I think the a big part of it too, just from what I know of how this beautiful universe works, is when your intention is so strong and your mission is so clear and it really is to serve the world in a greater way, that people will come along on your mission and they do want to help.
Eventually.
Eventually.
Because you also can get your ass beat.
That too.
99 times.
Yes. Let's talk about the ass beating. What were the hardest, what was the hardest ass beat for you? I think I know which one it is, but what was the toughest one for you?
When it came to getting interviews, yeah. Warren Buffett, just, that was the hardest. And with Buffett, I just assumed, you know, if you look at any interview with Warren Buffett, he always talks about how much he loves college students and young people and helping them and giving them advice. I was like, look, if anyone's going to do an interview with me, it's going to be Warren Buffett. Mm-hmm. And that was the biggest mistake I could have made, because I ended up spending 8 months of my life 100% committed to getting to Warren Buffett. And I wrote him letter after letter after letter after letter after letter after letter, calling his assistant week after week after week after week after week. And you have to understand, after 3 months of rejection, you feel like your life is over. By 6 months of rejection, you're pretty much coughing up blood. Mm. And it was, what's funny is that was actually the darkest time of the entire book journey. Not just because of the amount of rejections, but also because of the place of desperation I was in. I could not see another way of this dream being a reality without Warren Buffett.
Why is that?
Because I had blinders on. And why did I have blinders on? Because I was terrified. I was young and didn't have the experience to know. You know, if I were to write another book and someone was rejecting me for 8 months, first of all, I wouldn't even be getting myself into that 8 month mess in the first place. I would know, you know, that's not a fight you want to fight. I didn't understand. And I don't knock myself. I had to learn at some point in my life, and I learned then, which is that, yeah, the book's going to be fucking awesome whether Warren Buffett's in it or not. I didn't understand that though. And I get it. You know, I didn't have any, you know, I had sold my publisher on this dream of I'm going to get Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and all this stuff. I had dropped out of college telling my family, don't worry, I got this. I had told my friends, don't worry, I got this. I told my literary agent, don't worry, I got this. And I didn't. And it was all crumbling. And I had dug myself into a very deep hole. And that's what made it so dark.
When you were in that dark time, what was most supportive for you?
Ice cream?
What flavor? And
I say that half jokingly.
I actually just bought a pint of ice cream yesterday to eat the whole thing, nice. So I can relate.
Look, ice cream is very helpful. The reason I say that half jokingly, and I almost want to walk back that joke, is because I've become more aware, especially this past year, of me and, you know, even my family's use of sugar and food as a way to cope with pain. I'm slowly becoming more and more aware and conscious of it. So I almost want to stop making jokes about it. I used to make a lot of jokes about it. I want to be more thoughtful and give it the respect, you know, something like that deserves. Some people use alcohol. Some people use drugs.
Some people use social media.
Yeah. Some people use social media. You know, we use, you know, Chunky Monkey ice cream, you know. It's funny. All those things can kill you. Actually, crazy to think about it. Mm-hmm. Anyways, going back to the question of how I coped, sometimes it would be dissociating with food, but that was very rare. I think that wouldn't help in the long term. That would help for an hour.
It would, yeah, be a
month. What helped for the long term? What helped for the long term was in the darkest, darkest times. Two things. One, do you remember the movie Castaway?
Yes.
With Tom Hanks?
Yep.
Where he's on a desert island and he has no one to talk to, and he ends up talking to a volleyball named Wilson. And it's like his only friend. Yes. Sometimes entrepreneurship feels like that. You're on a desert island. There's no one, you know, you feel you can talk to. And to me, that volleyball, that Wilson, was this idea and this dream of what this book would do for other people. The reason I got into it in the first place. And I just had this dream that if all these people came together, not for press, not to promote anything, but really just to share their best wisdom with the next generation, young people could do so much more. And that belief would be the only thing that helped me from completely letting go. And it wouldn't be like I would have that belief and I would jump out of bed, re-energize. No, it would just be that one little thread that would keep me hanging on. Now, what would really help me? And you know, you turn on, you know, Instagram, you turn on any motivational video on YouTube, and there's just like a chorus of people yelling, never give up, never take breaks. Fuck that, you know? No. Take a fucking break, totally. You know?
I've learned that, yep.
And this is the thing. I'm not saying, you know, take a three-month vacation. I'm saying when you're getting your ass beat, giving up, you know, taking a break and being lazy is bad. What's even worse, though, is burning yourself out to the point that you completely have to stop working on your dream.
Mm-hmm. Or repair your health, because like for me, that's actually where it got to.
Right?
Yeah.
Or God forbid, you know, you work yourself so hard that you start having mental health issues and you start making disastrous decisions that sabotage your dream in and of itself. So taking a break is not the enemy. You know, losing on your dream is the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes taking that break, whether it's taking an afternoon off, turning off your phone, watching a movie, going for a walk, going for a bike ride,
breathing, meditating, connecting with people you love.
Yeah, take that fucking weekend off and hang with your friends.
Yep.
Is actually the thing that ensures the long-term dream comes to fruition.
Mm-hmm. What was your most proud third door moment in your journey to make this book?
I'll tell you what was the happiest moment of the entire journey, especially recently. And it's not so, it's a little of a third door story. I pretty much got for the book launch. And pretty much everything has a third door aspect to it at this point. Mm-hmm. And on the day the book came out, we got a giant billboard in Times Square, like the size of a high rise, you know, for free through a friend. And my mom came. She came to New York. And actually, I didn't know this until months later. It was the first time she's ever traveled to like a major city by herself.
Wow.
In her whole life. And her being there in Times Square and her face, it's
another one of those moments that's scorched in your memory.
Yeah, you can never forget it.
Yeah. What, gosh, there's so much more, and I know we've got a hard stop, but how do you inspire yourself?
I love art. And my friends are amazing artists. I'm just a human being, you know? I love great art, whether it's a good book, whether it's stand-up comedy. I think stand-up comedy is like one of our last remnants of pure philosophy. You know, back in the day, we had Plato and Aristotle. Now we have fucking Dave Chappelle and Jerry Seinfeld. But I'm not kidding. I'm not joking. I really do think if you watch Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee and you transcribe what's being said, you have some of the deepest observations of humanity in there. And that is the job of a stand-up comedian,
mm-hmm.
to study what the human experience is, find that thing that we all have experienced but no one's even put into words, and do it in a way that's funny. Now that's a hard job.
That is a hard job.
And it's one of the highest art forms in my opinion. But you know, anything by Lin-Manuel is amazing. I love his musical In the Heights. Of course, Hamilton. I've never seen Hamilton, but I listened to the soundtrack hundreds of times. Books, Pema Chodron, Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah,
Judd Apatow's book right now. It's been out for a few years, but I've been reading it, you know, a lot the past few months, sick in the head.
Did you have a vision that this book would bring the success that you're experiencing right now?
You know, I dreamed, and it's a lot of the fuel that kept me going for 7 years. Now, what's funny is that although I imagined it in my head for these 7 years, actually experiencing it makes me feel so surreal because I feel like I'm trapped in like one of my daydreams from 7 years ago. And I have to look around and like, even seeing the book on a table. What's crazy to me is walking somewhere and seeing the book in the wild. Mm. You know, walking through an airport and seeing the book, walking through a Barnes & Noble and seeing it. Even just going on Instagram and seeing people's Instagram stories, I'm just like, what? Mm. How do you have that? Or like, what's even the most surreal is, you know, I've been doing the book tour for, I've been on tour for 6 months nonstop. And, you know, in the beginning of the tour, it was very normal. I go on the tour, no one's heard of The Third Door. My job is to share the story. That I'm comfortable with. What's been crazy is now in the recent months, I go on tour and people are holding copies of the book. I'm like, hey, the book signing is not for 2 hours. Where'd you get that? And they're like, what do you mean? It's my copy. I was like, what? And I'm like, did you buy it today? They're like, no, I bought it 6 months ago. I was like, what? And I'm like, have you started reading it? They're like, I've read it 4 times.
That's why I'm here, is to meet you.
And that's what's still very new to me. Oh, and
so cool.
You know, people say I'm so humble. No, I'm literally so fucking humbled when I hear that, to the point where it's shocking.
So beautiful. All right, let's close this up. What is something unique about you that most people don't know?
I feel like I talked about it a lot on this podcast for some reason about my sisters, but I am super, super close to my two sisters.
And when you're... Well, we kind of talked about this too, but curious, when you're in a really dark place, what's your go-to to get out?
I breathe through it. That's a very like fluffy way to describe it, but I do start by just acknowledging it. It depends where I am. If I'm traveling, I'll journal. If it's something that I sort of need to switch gears, I will reach out to one of my best friends, one of my sisters, and talk it through. Or if I'm here in LA, I'll, you know, make a mental note that I want to talk about it in therapy. If there's something that I've learned, it's that all human beings go through hardship and pain. All we can control is how we relate to that pain. Are you going to fight it? Are you going to tuck it away, pretend it doesn't exist? Or are you going to look at it?
Love it. Embrace it.
And try to say, hey, I know you're part of me. Let's go through this together.
Beautiful. And knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your 10-year-old self?
Relax, man. It's going to be great.
Awesome. Alex, thank you so much. I have so much more I'm curious about, but we will close it out there. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm beyond thrilled for the success of this book, the impact that it's having, that you're going global. Hell yeah. And I can't wait to gift my copy to somebody because I read this book. I just got my copy, guys. Alex signed a copy for me here. But thank you. And anything I can do to support you, let me know.
It's a ton. Thank you.
Isn't Alex's journey incredible? I mean, he really shows the power of resilience and what's possible when you stay committed to your vision and you're open to finding a way, to finding your third door and not quitting when one thing or one strategy didn't work. It doesn't mean it won't work. It just means that it's time to expand your creativity and to strengthen your level of faith to find a new way to achieve your goals and dreams. Now, it's all possible as long as you stay on the path and you keep on going no matter what. And a big part that contributes to achieving your vision and your goals and your dreams is belief. Belief in yourself, belief in knowing that it can happen, that it will happen, and belief that you're worthy and deserving of having what you want. Now that is what has you keep going, even when it's hard. So if you're struggling to hit your goal or dream, or you're working hard and you aren't experiencing the results that you want, then there's some belief change work that needs to happen.
And if you want some support with that, you know I've got you, because I created a badass holistic course showing you exactly how to use self-hypnosis to radically change your beliefs on a subconscious level so that you can create an entirely new reality for yourself. So if you've been struggling to get or to have the things that you want, whether that's more money, to have that loving and trusting romantic relationship, to get to your ideal weight or health, or if you just want to feel more happy and at peace within yourself, then you definitely want to check out Believe, which is my self-hypnosis course. And in this course, you know, I show you how to get out of your own way by programming new and empowering beliefs at a subconscious level that align with what you want, so that you stop the struggle and you can easily be, do, and have everything that you want. Now, I go in deep into the exact steps that I use to practice self-hypnosis that's been a game changer for my life. And this is also what I teach my private clients to build a new future for themselves that looks and feels exactly how they want. Now, I give away a lot of secrets that I use with my private clients that you can use for yourself. And it's game time to finally have what you want. So if you're ready and you want that support, go to stephaniekwong.com/self-hypnosis to learn more. And of course, to get yourself into the awesome and powerful practice of self-hypnosis to build a new future for yourself that includes everything that you want to be and have. And I'll also put up that link in the show notes page for you. I hope you enjoyed this episode with Alex. He's absolutely incredible. His story is amazing, and I love all the insights and everything that he shared from his journey and everything that he learned along the way that you can integrate into your life to support in staying on the path to your dreams. Now, if there's someone that you know who could benefit from hearing from Alex's story and all the wisdom that he shared, please, please, please share it out with them, because there may be something in this episode that is the very thing that the people you love need to hear that will support them in achieving their dreams and goals. And also, if you got value from this episode and you want more, make sure that you subscribe to the podcast. And if it feels aligned for you, I'd be deeply grateful if you'd leave me a 5-star review on iTunes. It just takes a couple minutes, but these reviews really help to boost the show to be visible by more people. And I'd really appreciate your support with that so that we can inspire even more people to rise higher together. And if you've already left a review, thank you, thank you, thank you so very much. All right, for everything that we mentioned in today's episode and for links to connect with Alex and to buy a copy of his book, The Third Door, which you definitely want to get your eyeballs on, you can check it out in the show notes, and that's over at stephaniekwong.com/EP46. And feel free to check out all my other podcast episodes there too, because there's a whole lot of other amazing episodes with inspiring guests for you to tune into. Okay, my friends, until next time, you know I'm sending you so much love.